Welcome to the Red Rock Fantasy Basketball Podcast. My name is Josh Lloyd. Welcome if you are watching on YouTube, if you're listening to this on a podcast, or if you're listening to this on the Hardwood Paroxysm Network. Hope that you are enjoying what you're hearing, and make sure you are subscribing to this podcast on iTunes or on YouTube. Subscribe on both. That would be awesome. I am joined today for this podcast. We're doing a podcast based on NBA basketball analytics, and I'm joined by a first-time guest for the Red Rock Fantasy Basketball Podcast, Mika Honkasalo. Mika, how are you going?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Not a problem. It's good to have you on. Now, Mika, where can everybody find you on Twitter? Let's get that out of the way straight away.
It's at M Honkasalo, so the first letter of my first name and my last name. It should be in the description if it's hard to tell based on you just saying it.
You'll be able to see Mika's name and his Twitter account all over my Twitter account, which is redrock_bball, in the show notes to this as well. You can find him everywhere. Now, Mika does a lot of basketball analytics work at Nylon Calculus, so I do encourage you to check out not only his work at Nylon Calculus, but all the guys over there, Seth and the rest of the team over at Nylon Calculus. There's a whole stack of work that is really, really interesting if you are at all interested in basketball analytics. Now, Mika, people can probably tell that you do have somewhat of an accent, like myself, not the same accent. Whereabouts are you coming to us from at the moment?
I'm from Finland, one of the only basketball analytics guys from Finland.
I would say almost definitely the only basketball analytics guy from Finland. Finland's not exactly a basketball hotspot. Not a lot of basketball going on over there. You were telling me before. How did you get into basketball?
It was just 4 or 5 years ago, I think I saw my first game, maybe a bit more than that. It was the KG, Ray Allen, Paul Pierce, Celtics, and I just thought that was like the coolest thing ever, and I started watching their games, and slowly after that I started watching more and more and sort of got into the NBA community and then saw the people who were discussing it, and I wanted to be a part of the discussion, so that's how I got into doing this thing.
So me and Mika both used to write at an Australian basketball site, pickandroll.com.au, and that's where I first got in contact with Mika over there. Now he writes at Nylon Calculus. I'm writing at RotoWire, obviously, and at Hardwood Paroxysm, so we're joined together again there. Now, Mika, what sort of stuff do you do in your life that lends itself to basketball analytics?
So I study computer science at university, and I work as like a business analytics and software development consultant. So I have a strong technical background, and that lends itself to working in basketball analytics. So I understand like the math that goes into it, and I can create it myself also.
So basically, you're a nerd, much like me.
That's a good description.
Different fields of nerddom, but the nerds are a big part of basketball these days, and a lot of great stuff comes out of looking at numbers, and not even looking at numbers, but developing new numbers and developing new techniques of looking at things. Before we get too much into that, though, Mika, what I wanted to mention is I had a couple of questions come at me today via Twitter and via email regarding the Red Rock Listener Leagues and free agent auction budgets. Now, I'm not going to tailor this directly to the leagues. I just want to throw something out there. If you guys have never used a free agent auction budget in your fantasy league before, I do encourage you to do it. It's the fairest way of being able to acquire players off the waiver wire. Basically, what it is players are not available. You can't just pick players up whenever you want. The players are there. You get a budget. So the one that I set in our league is $100. So you get $100 for the year, and you can set it up any way you want, but I've set it up that every day you can go out there and look who's available and throw out a blind bid. So say someone's out there, say Kelly Olynyk is out there on the waiver wire. You go, I really want Kelly Olynyk on my team. I'm going to throw a bid out of $1. If Mika looks at it and goes, I want Kelly Olynyk as well. He doesn't know that I want him, and he doesn't know I've placed a bid. But he goes, I think that I'm going to value Kelly Olynyk at $2. Then after that 24-hour period is done, they go through and look at all the claims, put on all the players. Whoever bid the most for those players gets them. So Mika would then get Kelly Olynyk at $2, and his season budget would go down from 100 down to 98. And that happens every day. So it's not like, oh, I'm going to look at 5 o'clock and I'm going to go and add a player and add them to my team. And then, no, I don't like that one. I'm going to move another guy. It doesn't work like traditional free agency and waiver wise. It requires a lot more thought. Everybody then has a chance at getting those players. It's not whoever is active and whoever is watching the game and sees Ricky Rubio go down and then they quickly grab Mo Williams. It's like, okay, everyone knows that Rubio's gone down. Then everyone goes in and puts their bid on Mo Williams, and whoever puts the most on gets him. And that's what we're doing in all the Red Rock Listener Leagues, and I do really encourage everybody to do that in all their leagues. It is the fairest way of being able to get free agents onto teams. It's not based on timing, on time zones, on who's watching what game and who goes down and all that sort of stuff. It gives everyone a chance, and there's that extra layer of strategy. So I just wanted to get that out there. If anyone does have any more questions about how the free agent auction budget goes, let me know and I'll explain it further, but I think hopefully that would have got the point across. Now, Mika, we were talking a little bit before, said you had played some fantasy a couple of years back. Explain to us what you did in your fantasy leagues with your analytic bend on things.
Yeah, so lots of analytics leagues, at least from what I've seen, they count up like it's about counting up box score stats.
Yep.
And there's only so much information that's contained within that, so I sort of wanted to, for example, something that isn't captured by box scores, defense. Most of, like 80% of defense isn't captured by steals and blocks and fouls. That only makes up 20% of all the possessions. So I wanted to mix in other methods like adjusted plus minus system, sort of like real plus minus, to start measuring players' defense better and get like a get a fantasy score every night that better reflected what actually happened on the court, more than just who put up the big counting stats.
It's a very interesting way of looking at it, because fantasy is dominated by the standard old school box scores that have been around for the last 20, 30 years. Points, three-pointers, rebounds, assists, blocks, steals, field goal percentage, free throw percentage. Now, sometimes you'll see leagues dabble in other things, adjusted field goal percentage, true shooting percentage, assist to turnover ratio, all that sort of stuff. But I was talking about this, Mika, and when I was at Summer League and the NBA introduced the hustle stats, which they didn't really publish much. They just, for some reason, allowed the writers to look at, and that was about it. It was a bit of a weird way of doing it. But I could see an ability for those things like hustle stats to become fantasy categories, deflections and charges drawn and shots contested and all that sort of stuff. Stuff which does, as you say, gives a better indication of how the players or how much value the players have without it necessarily showing up. And a guy that I always come back to when I think about that is a player like Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, who is considered one of the better defenders in the NBA, but he doesn't put up any defensive box score numbers. He doesn't get steals. He doesn't get blocks. But he does a lot more other things. And I think that's what we're all trying to get at when we're looking at stats, is finding better ways to represent players who do the right thing and who do things well. And I think Kidd-Gilchrist is one of those examples. So, Mika, it's going to take a while for those sort of analytics numbers to catch on to be commonplace in fantasy leagues, but I think they should start to become more of an option in leagues, and it's definitely a different way around it. And I think it would change your fantasy experience a lot. Now,
yeah, lots of
go.
Yeah, lots of big men suffer from the same thing. Blocks really aren't a very good indication of how well you're protecting the rim, but lots of like Marcus All doesn't get the most blocks, but he always Andrew Bogut doesn't get the most blocks, but he always leads the league. But DeAndre Jordan gets the most blocks, and opponent field goal percentage at the rim, he's something like average only, and that's something that clearly, you're looking for big men who get blocks, but that doesn't actually tell how they've played on the defensive end.
It's definitely a weird sort of situation with some of those numbers, but we are getting better at describing it. And that's what we're sort of going to talk about here. We're going to talk about some advanced stats, Mika. We're also going to talk about ways that we can use advanced stats to sort of be able to predict jump up in player performance, regressions in player performances, things that we can, or the listeners, you guys listening, can sometimes or maybe have a slight edge in terms of your fantasy league and which guys might be primed for a breakout and what sort of numbers we can look at to base that on and where we get that. Now, we hear the term advanced stats, we hear advanced metrics, analytics, all those sort of terms. It's all interchangeable. What are the most common ones that we see, Mika? What are the most common ones that are sort of bridging the gap between, you know, basketball nerddom and mainstream? What are those common ones that you see bandied about now?
Well, I think that at least we will continue to see more and more things that are easily represented in like graphic form, so that you don't have to understand points per possession, but when you see a shot chart that has red and green and yellow on it, you sort of get what's happening and how a player is shooting just visually. And I think lots of those things will start making themselves into like the mainstream, like TV broadcasts and stuff like that. ESPN had a thing from Vantage Sports where it showed Jeff Teague driving to the basket, and it had something like Jeff Teague beats his man something percent of the time, and 30% of the time he makes the pass there, 30% of the time he drives himself to the rim or whatever, and it makes like a nice graphic. And I think those things that are easily put into a visual form will make it into the mainstream. I think for like more basketball people, things like adjusted plus minus and blocks plus minus, they've sort of made their way into the discussion, but I think the understanding of those metrics isn't at a high level yet, and I think that they can get easily misused and misrepresented.
Yeah, well, that's something.
So I think.
Go ahead.
No, I was done. Go ahead.
I was going to say that's something that we should talk about, because there is, you know, ESPN's got their metric. There's the BPM metric as well, adjusted plus minus, all that sort of stuff, and you see them on different sites, and you know, ESPN has their own, you know, proprietary formula. They don't necessarily share how they come about with these numbers, and it does make things a little bit confusing in terms of, you know, which one is the most accurate. How do we go about looking at them? So, you know, probably the most common of these numbers that we use to determine overall player value is player efficiency rating, the PER, which is the John Hollinger stat from a few years ago, where everyone's graded on a correct me if I'm wrong here, Mika, but 15 is an average NBA player. Yeah, above 15 means you're good. Over 20,
yes,
getting to good. 25, excellent. 30 is unbelievable. Below 15, below average, obviously. And it takes. You can explain how does PER work? Like, what sort of categories are we looking at that it takes into to give us this one number?
So PER can sort of be simplified as the best single representation of everything that was in a box score. So it doesn't contain any information out of that, but it technically tries to take everything that there is to take out of that and sort of weight different values and take into account pace and per minute things and put them into one number. So you could technically sum up a daily box score with a PER-like number every day that tells how well you did. Overall, I think these all-in-one metrics, they usually get sort of a bad rap. People say that, oh, numbers guys say that this one number says it all, but of course it doesn't. It doesn't take into defense or context. That's sort of a straw man argument, because I've never heard any numbers guys actually say that. But they're only as good as their methodologies, and PR, I don't think, is always a very good predictor not a very good metric to show how good you are, but it provides like a statistical baseline for you to analyze, so that you can analyze a player's career with PR quite well and understand how, when they started getting better, when they started getting worse, because you have created this sort of box score statistical baseline against which this player is working his whole career.
So when you look at PER, one of the more important things to look at is that it is based on, you know, per possession or per minute. So it's, you know, guys who are on the bench aren't at a disadvantage from a traditional counting stat point of view. So that if you play 10 minutes or 15 minutes, you can still have an above average PER, because it's all based on per minute sort of numbers. So that's an important thing. Now, other things like BPM and that sort of stuff, do you have a particular number that you like in these sort of catch-all type metrics? Like, which one stands out to you? There's obviously not a perfect situation at this point, but is there something there where you go, this is a good number that is something that you turn to and use more often than, say, the others?
Well, I always, like, if you just go through Basketball Reference, I think I always like to use win shares more than PER. Yep. A win share is when you do, like, the math it and add up all the win shares, it actually correlates pretty nicely with wins. So it does measure holistically where it doesn't measure defense very well. You can get some weird results, but the overall package, as it comes to these one metric numbers, I don't think win shares is a bad one to use. I do like adjusted plus minus systems like ESPN's Real Plus Minus. There's sort of all this regression calculation and constantly analyzing each who's on the court, and it's like this litany of sort of constantly changing values, which makes it prone to variance. So it's not very, you can't use it to see anything in one game, but over a season, or probably you need actually even more data than that, you can see very, very well to me how a player performed over a long period of time, given the context that they played in.
Yeah, like I look at win shares quite a lot, and I've found it to be relatively informative in terms of what it's providing in comparing players throughout their career and all that sort of stuff. Now, other stuff that we can look at. Let's talk about you and what you do with looking at these advanced stats. Now, in terms of people listening who are playing in fantasy basketball leagues, we want to look at guys who we think are going to take a big jump. So we look at players last year like Draymond Green, Jimmy Butler. They're two guys who come to mind immediately. Pau Gasol had a big jump in what he was able to do from his last season in LA to his time in Chicago. Reggie Jackson, when he headed across to Detroit, played a lot better than even when he was the starter in Oklahoma City. So give us three names of players that you could see that could be taking a similar leap to this, and how do you determine that? What do you use to sort of identify those players so that we can keep an eye on that for other guys? And is there something that's a good predictor, an average predictor, all that sort of stuff? Go ahead, give us some names.
So first, the sort of the methods that you usually like to use, there are at least like three obvious ones. One is context. If you get put in a context that's clearly better for you, where you have more outside shooting, for some reason, when you do like the math of how much each box score stats count towards winning, you actually get that steals are more valuable than you could have ever thought. And no one's actually really sure why you get that result, but I think it says something. And it also, like, draft guys who do analytics for players coming into the draft, they also really like steal rates.
Yep.
So it says probably something about either your athleticism or your some sort of vision to get into passing lanes and stuff like that translates into other areas of the game. And then there's variance. So this is how I got on the Timofey Mozgov bandwagon like 3-4 years, like a long time ago before he was a starter on a finals team, which was that when you looked at his stats, he would have games where in 10 minutes he would have 8 rebounds, in 15 minutes he could have 10. And he had those games just often enough. And then I watched those games and like sort of thought, can this translate over into a bigger sample size of minutes? And then I thought it could. So variance is one of those big things that you're looking for, someone who has like big performances, even if they don't get to play much, they have a few big ones at least. And those are good indicators. So besides like the obvious young guys I picked, when I was preparing for this, either Deron Williams or JaVale McGee under Rick Carlisle, that would be the context thing. So one of those guys has a good chance of working out well in Carlisle's system. McGee, because there's a lot of space on the floor for him to roll, and Deron, because I think the motion offense would be good for him, and Chandler Parsons can handle the ball some, and he can work off the ball. And then
Well, before we go on, Mika.
Yeah.
Do you think JaVale will start over Zaza Pachulia?
No, I don't. I don't think he will start. Carlisle probably isn't that happy with that they have JaVale McGee as their go-to rim protector. So I don't think he'll start. And Zaza's pretty good, a pretty good offensive player, and he'll fit in nicely with Dirk offensively. It's the defense that it will be a fiasco.
Yeah, it's not going to be good with those two out there, but. Yeah, I agree. I think the Pachulia gets probably 28 minutes and McGee 18 to 21, but he can still be impactful in 18 to 21 minutes. JaVale, he can still go out there and get block three shots. And it's interesting that you brought his name up because he was only just a recent signing. Continue with what else you were saying there.
I think another one who has a clear context upgrade is Tim Hardaway Jr., who I don't like at all as a player. But he has an opportunity to, if he can play defense, to actually become a good NBA player on the Hawks. And the Hawks are clearly betting on themselves too, that they can make this happen out of apparently almost anyone. Yeah. And another one, I think, like not a real flashy name, but I think Patrick Patterson will have a bigger role now that Amir Johnson is gone. And he was actually, one thing I really like to look at is like on-off court numbers. I think those are some of the best stuff you can typically look at. And he was a plus-minus star. So when he was on the court, they were actually a top five team in net rating, which is a very good, better than wins at sort of evaluating team performance. And when he was off the court, they were actually 15. So that's a pretty big jump. And I think he does some very interesting things on the court that could work for Toronto more.
I really like those. You know, I don't like Tim Hardaway, but you don't like him either. But there is a position open there in Atlanta with Damari Carroll going to Toronto. Kyle Korver will probably play more three. So, you know, there's Kent Bazemore there. There's Thabo Sefolosha there. Hardaway is truly a garbage player, but there is an opportunity. And if the Hawks can teach him to, you know, respect the team and to play within the constraints of their system, he's definitely got ability. I think a lot of it is mental for him. And if he buys in, yeah, look, it could be a big breakout. So he's someone to watch for. I really love the fact that you highlighted Darren Williams because I really do. I much like Tim Hardaway, I'm not a fan of Darren Williams at all. Not at all. I outlined that a few shows ago. But I really think that he's got a big opportunity for a bounce-back season. There are a number of factors that were limiting him in Brooklyn, I feel. Obviously, injuries, unhappiness, system as well. And I think that he could have a really a significant increase in what he's able to do. And I'm glad that you highlighted those guys. And Patrick Patterson, Tupat, there's not many other guys up there in Toronto to take minutes of him. Louis Scola's not going to take too many minutes away from him, I wouldn't have thought. So he's not only going to get more playing time and more opportunity, but as you said, he's primed for that breakout with those minutes and the way that he performed last year. So you say that on off numbers are one of the bigger things that you look for in breakout players.
Yeah, I think that's, and actually it's not just breakout players, I actually look for that in all players. On off numbers sort of to me even better sometimes than adjusted plus minus is supposed to adjust that plus minus that you see on the off court numbers. But I think if you think about it yourself, and think about who this player plays with and who he plays against, you actually can be probably better than the best math in the world at sort of figuring out his adjusted plus minus from his on off court plus minus. Because adjusted plus minus is supposed to take into who you play against, who you play with, and stuff like that, and because of that, it's the math isn't perfect, so your human eye can sort of do some of those things better, I think.
Okay, it's definitely very very interesting sort of work. Obviously, nothing's ever going to be 100%. We're never going to be able to predict everything with 100% accuracy, but we're always trying to get better at all this stuff, Mika. Now, speaking of trying to get better, with all the stats that the NBA puts out, and I don't know if you're in this boat, but I look at the NBA.com stats page, and it's improved in leaps and bounds the last couple of years. Are you impressed with what they've done with the stats that they're putting out for public consumption on that website, the videos and all the breakdowns that they have on there? It seems to have come a long way. Are you happy with what they put out there?
I think that in what we track, I think there's lots of things like the synergy numbers are now publicly available, and they didn't used to be. So and everything on the NBA stats side, like how you shoot when there's a defender within 2 feet, 5 feet from you. I think there are a lot of things are now tracked, and there's sort of lots of data available. But I don't know if analytics as a whole has quite made the impact that I thought it could have at best. Like clearly more shots are being taken at the rim or from 3-point land, and actually it's not just the mid-range shots that's gone. It's like the 5 to 9 feet shot that's also that analytics has almost killed completely. Teams have realized that is an efficient shot. So I beyond like sort of shot selection and stuff like that, I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah, so where do we need to work? Where does the NBA community need to work? What stats do we really need to focus on, or areas do we need to develop that can really sort of take the game to another level? What do we need to look at? What's an area where you think that focus should be centered?
I think we've done sort of enough in perhaps tracking things and quantifying players in one number, but to really understand context and defense is something like, for example, we have rim protection numbers for every big man, how opposing players shoot when this big man is close to the basket. But rim protection is a team thing that starts on the perimeter. Like, remember like in the playoffs when Houston put Dirk in pick and rolls over and over and over again, and then it was just a disaster every time. Poor Tyson Chandler would have to rotate over, and then it would either be a lob from Josh Smith to Howard on top, or if he didn't rotate over, it was a dunk every single time. But it was just like a disaster. And that says something about how Dirk can't defend pick and rolls anymore. But also, I think those pick and rolls change in some very, very significant ways. If instead of JJ Barea, you have Mike Conley helping him, out, so all the passing angles get tighter and all that sort of stuff. And I think that would show up in Dirk's rim protection numbers. But now you're only measuring his rim protection, and you're not thinking about the context in which he's working also. So I think context and defense still have a long way to go.
Okay. Now, if anyone goes through your Twitter feed, Mika, they would have seen you tweet a number of things about a couple of these players that I want to get your thoughts on. A couple of former Utah Jazz teammates, Enes Kanter and Rudy Gobert. There are a lot of stats, a lot of things that you put out about those guys. Let's start with Kanter. He's widely derided as being a horrible defender, and in some people's opinion, that makes him a horrible basketball player. What's your take on Enes Kanter? How do you see him surviving, thriving in Oklahoma City now that Kevin Durant is back and now that Serge Ibaka is back? What's your take on Kanter? Do your numbers, or do you look at the numbers, do they put out something different to what is the mainstream thought on him?
I think I really, from when the season started tweeting a lot about how much better the Jazz were with Gobert than Kanter, and then it was clear that Kanter is probably the worst defensive player in the league. But I also think that the discussion went a bit too far in the other direction. People started comparing Kanter with Dion Waiters, and you should at least have some imagination that if Kanter does clearly some things very, very well, offensive rebounding, posting up, he can even shoot it a little bit, but I think you should really be careful not to say that this is, like, if he just becomes okay on defense, the numbers will shift radically. Like, if he can get, it's clearly possible for him to get from the worst defensive player in the league into something okay. And if he does that, his value changes completely.
We saw James Harden do that, go from one of the worst perimeter defenders to becoming an okay defender. and it changed a lot about what he was able to do, and you know, thrust him into a guy that captured the Players Association MVP, you know, second in the NBA MVP award, because he was able to take his defense from laughable to passable. And what you're saying with Kanter, because Kanter's offensive game is very good. I don't think many people could argue with that. And he just needs to get to that average level. Now, but how does that fit in with Oklahoma City? Can he do that? Do Oklahoma City have a history of being able to improve people's defensive numbers?
Well, one thing that's going to happen, obviously, is that he's going to be tied at the hip with Ibaka. They're not going to let him play much without, or they shouldn't. That you have to have Ibaka helping him out defensively, at least for the foreseeable future. So I think that's a thing that they'll do. And the OKC, when their defense went down the drain at the end of last season, but they scored like 120 points per game also, I think everyone was part of the problem at that point. Like Russell Westbrook, who's a really good athlete, and people somehow think he's a good defender, but watch him on pick and rolls, and every single fake, he overreacts, he's jumping in wrong spots and whatever. And like, everyone was a part of the problem, and raining down the perimeter defense, getting KD back, who's actually one of the best defenders in the league, which goes unnoticed often. I think those things mixed in with having Ibaka with Kanter will make it so that he's, at least in a regular season, a very, very good contributor to the team.
So is Ibaka's defense, is that enough to cover what Kanter does? And does that allow the Thunder to go out there and play him 30 minutes a night?
I think nowadays it is. Ibaka was one of those players who was long overrated as a defender because he was shot blocker, but his actual skills sort of caught up to that reputation now. And it should be fine having Kanter with Ibaka.
So do you see Kanter being the starter there, ahead of Steven Adams?
Well, at least because they pay him a lot.
That's true.
Personally, I wouldn't. I think Steven Adams is the better fit and possibly the better player, given what they have. But that would be amazing if they paid him $70 million or whatever and didn't start him. I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I don't either. I think that, and I said this even when he was playing in Utah, that his offense is great, his defense is horrible, but just pair him with someone that plays defense. Like, you know, they could have paired him with Gobert more in Utah. They just pair him with Ibaka, someone who can make up for his lapses and just let him, you know, because he can take guys off double teams on offense. He can take guys off triple teams and still score. He's got that offensive ability. It's just the other end where he's is he lost? Is he lazy? Does he not care? Has he got bad fundamentals, bad technique?
Like, first of all, he's sort of slow and doesn't jump and doesn't have a long reach, so those things don't help. But just every rotation, he's like, just like focus on his helps and look at what happens, and you immediately start to see how he corrodes every possession with everything he does. Particularly when he has to rotate, he's just always late or in the wrong spot. He does deserve that reputation for now. He is the worst defensive big in the league right now.
Interesting. Now, before we get on to the next guy, which is Rudy Gobert, who is clearly the opposite of that, we did have a question come in from Tony Stark, who's got a question for me about usage. Tony Stark, one of my Twitter followers. Every tweet he sends out, hashtag Iron Man, Stark's Industries, his Twitter. I'm convinced, and I'm yet to be proven wrong, that it's Robert Downey Jr. hiding his basketball love under a fake account. So Mr. Robert Downey Jr., he asked the question to us, what are your thoughts on usage rate? So what does that, you know, we know what usage rate is. You can explain what usage rate is to everyone.
So usage rates, and you should separate usage rate and usage percentage, which often get mixed up with each other. The other one takes into account only scoring or shooting possessions, and the other one takes passing and shooting possessions. So what comes to mind about usage would at least be that what Westbrook did at the end of last season clearly started hitting the very, very high end of what a single player should use the ball at least.
What numbers was it? He was getting up at about 40%.
40%, and that's like that. If he had held that for the whole season, that would just be like the record by such a wide margin that doesn't even make sense.
Yeah, no, it's because normally if you see someone with a usage over 30, you go, okay, that's high. But he was, and that's why in daily fantasy, especially towards the end of last season, no matter what price that they put Russell Westbrook at, he was going to exceed the value of that price. Yeah, they'd put him at 12,000, 12,300, and it wouldn't matter because he'd routinely put in 65, 75-point daily fantasy performances because he was just doing everything. He just had the ball in his hand all the time. He was not just shooting it a lot, but he was passing it a lot and getting a ton of assist opportunities, and that's something that I guess it bears watching and watching if there's a trend with people's usage rate because it can lead to those situations in a daily fantasy or in a short-term seasonal league pickup that someone could be, you know, having this sort of hot streak and in a real chance to put up big numbers. Now, is there any correlation between, say, a player who's struggling but has high usage? Is there a correlation that they will turn it around, or does it lead to any sort of look ahead to the way their efficiency works or anything like that, or is it just completely up in the air?
Well, so quickly on Westbrook, I would also add that when he got those huge counting stats on huge usage, people said that made him an MVP candidate. But actually, that probably dropped him out of the discussion, and he was probably in there before that. He didn't make my top five. So when it comes to usage, if you're a high usage, low efficiency player, that's obviously very bad, and it's not obvious that your efficiency gets better as your usage gets lower, or it does in some cases, but not as often as you would think. But then you take the opposite, where you have a low usage but high efficiency player. They always deteriorate when you go towards higher usage, like always.
Okay, let's get on to Cantor's former teammate, and that's Rudy Gobert, because you've had a lot of tweets about him going out there as well. Okay, so we saw what he was able to do the second half of the season once he became the starter, just in terms of his ability to put up fantasy numbers and basically become the best defensive big man in the NBA over that time. Now, maybe you don't share that same opinion that he was the best defensive big man, but a lot of people do. Would you think he would have been?
I actually share that opinion. I think he was probably the best defender in the NBA in the last post All-Star, or the most impactful big man defender, at least. The on-off court numbers, I think, say it all. When Cantor was on the floor compared to when Gobert was on the floor, first of all, their defense jumped from pre to post All-Star from 27th to first, and they allowed 94 point something points per possession, which basically would have made them over a full season by far the best defense in NBA history, which is an amazing stat. And they had a net rating of a team who was expected to win about 58 games. So they were like really, really good. There's a reason why people are so high on them. And the difference between their defense is that when Gobert was on the floor, they were the best, the equivalent of having the best defense. And Enes Kanter, it's not enough to like go from the first defense all the way to the worst defense. You have to go to the worst defense and then actually come back about midway to the league. And then you get what's the difference between Gobert and Kanter's on-off court defensive numbers. So it's insane. And Gobert is a like once in a generation type of defender. I'm really high on him.
Now, he was a top 15 fantasy guy in head-to-head leagues post All-Star break. He was a top 30 guy for Roto leagues. Can he get better than what we saw in those last 2 months?
Yeah, I think he already has like sort of an interesting finishing game with sort of floaters and stuff like that around the rim. And I think that offensive game will expand a bit. I actually saw him play a couple of weeks ago when France played against Finland, and he was making mid-range shots in practice, in warm-ups before the game. And that looked like he had like a really, really smooth shot. So I think his offensive game will continue to expand. Gobert isn't actually just like a shot blocker on defense in the sense that he's also actually like a really smart and patient defender, and he rotates very well, like does smart things. He's really a favorite of mine.
I think he'll
continue to get a lot better.
We talk about all-time great defenders. From what you're seeing, from what the numbers show, does he project to be an all-time game-changing type defender?
Yeah, like I said, the defense allowed like 94.6 points per possession after the All-Star break, and that would have made them the best defense in modern NBA history, or the past 35 years or whatever. That's just like an insane number. It was so much better. Golden State's defense was the best, and it was just blew them out of the water completely. They've really, I think, started building something special in Utah. It's a pity that Exum is injured for the next season. But
that was going to be my next question. How much do you think that Dante Exum's, because Dante Exum was a plus defender as a rookie. The fact that you're taking him out of the lineup and putting Trey Burke in there, or Alec Burks, does that impact their defense? But I did hear something that Trey Burke's defensive numbers were actually really, really good post All-Star break as well. Are you concerned for that change?
So everyone's post All-Star numbers were incredible on the Jazz. That's just a function of playing with Rudy Gobert. But his numbers were actually, interestingly enough, a little bit better than Dante Exum, although I don't think that means really anything. So I think Dante Exum probably isn't really that good. But where it does hurt the Jazz is that they have to play Trey Burke.
Yep.
So that means a lot more inefficient shots. He's a really, really inefficient scorer. And just substituting, even if Dante Exum doesn't really do anything, like he can make corner threes, he knows he cuts well, he doesn't take up possessions. Like Favors and Hayward get all the best looks in the offense. And when Trey Burke needs the ball, I think it doesn't really help that. And I don't know. I have no idea if it will actually take away from their win totals, but I don't think it's a good thing at least.
Now, okay, let's talk about another guy that you've been tweeting about a lot, and that's DeAndre Jordan. But you've been tweeting about DeAndre Jordan's offensive ability. Do you care to explain what you mean by that?
So a couple of people have said this also, that DeAndre Jordan is quite clearly, at this point of his career, a better offensive player than a defensive player, which is really surprising because normally you hear that he's a defensive player of the year candidate, which he clearly isn't. He's not bad, but he's probably one of the 10 best centers, but he's not better than that. And the Clippers were actually a little bit better defensively with him off the court, which none of the best defensive players are. And he has bad habits on defense. You'll see him like situations where there's a 2-on-1 against him, and you can look at like Tim Duncan is probably the best at this. He'll cover sort of his man, but he'll also be ready to contest the shot from the guard if the guard wants to drive to the rim. And there's like sort of this little chess match going on when a player is driving into the lane. And DeAndre Jordan will just like overhelp, try to block the shot. It's a dump off pass dunk. Like just you look for that and you'll find those situations very often. But he is actually a very, very special offensive player. So especially given the context that he gets to play in with Blake and CP. So think of like a side pick and roll or a high pick and roll where Chris Paul hits a pocket pass to Blake Griffin, and now you have a 2-on-1 at the rim. If Chris Paul makes that pocket pass and he's one of the best at making it, that possession is already over. So when Blake Griffin is driving down the lane or gets the ball going straight to the basket, DeAndre's guy either has to help on him, which means it's a lob to DeAndre dunk every single time. You can't even foul him on those. It just goes by too quickly. And if you don't help, Blake will just dunk it on top of you. So, the idea of that basically is that, you know how most modern NBA defenses, they play the Thibodeau style of defense where the big man drops back, and in that defense, the big man sort of has to cover, for at least a little while, both the pick and roll ball handler while, the defender is trying to get over the pick and his man rolling to the rim. So there's two ways to beat that defense that are glitches in the system that completely change how you defend those situations. One is Steph Curry. So when he comes out with the pick, he can shoot at a high rate that pull-up three. And that's when you have to bring the big man up to trap him or hedge hard or something like that. The other one...
Mika is dropping out there. We'll see if we can get him back. Sorry. Oh, he's back. There he is.
Oh, sorry. What was the last thing I said?
You're talking about big men coming up to hedge on Steph Curry.
Yeah. So that's one way to beat the defense. So the other way to beat the defense is with the lob. So when the point guard comes into the lane and his man is chasing him, the big man has to cover sort of both of those players, his guy rolling to the rim. If his guy rolling to the rim can get the ball from like the top of the backboard and dunk it in, you create a passing angle that just doesn't exist for typical NBA players. And it's really, really hard to cover the lob in those situations. So, it's like the Tyson Chandler thing. Like, there are times when the defense breaks down and Tyson Chandler used to get like 3-4 dunks in a row. That's what happens with DeAndre Jordan. You create that passing angle where you can lob it and the guy who's standing on the free throw line trying to contain doesn't have a chance to go up there. So that sort of breaks down the defense. Also, there's the effect of just rolling down the rim. And what happens when someone has athletic, like even when he rolls down the rim, even if he doesn't get the lob, that means someone has to bump him in the lane so that he doesn't get the lob. But that means the weak side corner might be open. So it's his gravity when he rolls down the rim, rolls down the lane, and then it's also the passing angle he creates that this just doesn't exist for typical NBA players.
It's interesting to hear that sort of stuff about Jordan, because when you think about it, it makes sense that it's creating decoys and his. Yeah, making the defenders have to account for him and where he is and what he's doing. And it's obviously a very important part of NBA offenses, and it does open up things for a ton of other guys on that team. Now, Mika, before we spoke about players who are looking to take a leap next season, what about the other way? Are there any players who, based on maybe trends you've seen in their numbers or changes in opportunity, changes in coaching style, changes in fit with players around them, who are some good players that you think are a decent chance to regress this season?
So I try to pick non-obvious ones, so not like old players or players who are already bad. So I couldn't say like Derek Williams or Andrea Bargnani. But... I try to like pick sort of creative ones. One statistical one that's interesting is Damari Carroll. So first of all, you take him out of the Atlanta context, but second of all, before last season, he wasn't a 40% three-point shooter, and he doesn't actually shoot the free throw that well. He shot only 70.2%, which is below the league average. And that combination mixed in with that he's never shot above 37% in any of his previous seasons does give some indication that it's possible. Like, Damari Carroll will probably be pretty good. And I think in the playoffs, he showed in a bigger role where the offense wasn't coming to him that easily. And then the looks weren't as good that the Hawks got. And so that's one where he's likely to regress to about league average shooter. So he shot 39.5% last season. He'll probably, there's a good reason to believe he'll hit like 35.6% or something like that. So that's it doesn't make him a bad player. It does, but it does decrease his value somewhat there's a huge difference between being the 40% guy or the league average guy and how much gravity you're able to command on the court.
Okay.
So then another one I had was a context-dependent player, Gerald Green. Miami plays a lot slower than what he's used in Phoenix with D-Wade and Bosch getting up in age. So that's another one.
Yeah, Gerald Green struggled a lot in Phoenix even last year. So 2014, 13-14, Gerald Green was a lot different to what we saw in 14-15. And I don't think we'll see a huge amount for him. But Damari Kell is an interesting one because he's getting paid to be a bigger piece of things now in Toronto. But there is, as you mentioned, the chance that he actually is a worse player. So for people in fantasy leagues, you got to take that sort of advice on board and maybe not get too excited about Damari Kell. As good as he can be, there is a risk of him not necessarily being able to not even exceed what he did, but even maintain that level. There is that risk that he doesn't get quite to that level. So it's definitely an interesting sort of way to look at it.
And they can use him in interesting ways, like at the power forward position and stuff like that, that his production on the court sort of value-wise, just with his spacing, could be important. But it's probably quite likely that the fantasy numbers in terms of efficiency aren't quite there.
Okay. Now, what sort of advanced metrics do you think can help fantasy players? We've covered a few things already, but we mentioned a few numbers before. But what's an advanced metric that people can look at? Is it things like, you know, percentage of shots that they take from three for guards and small forwards and wing players? Is there any sort of numbers which you think can have a benefit for fantasy players?
Well, I guess if you're looking for benefits, it has to be something that isn't quite what other people are seeing. So I would say that one is looking at PER, that if a player's PER sort of started waning a little bit and it wasn't quite where it used to be in the last five seasons, maybe something that others haven't really realized is that, oh, he didn't quite rebound at the same level and maybe his efficiency didn't get to the line as much. So I would be looking at like players who sort of maybe regressed a little bit in PER, for example.
Okay. Now,
and then those breakout players. I think that's the way to win in your fantasy league. Just hit on those breakout players.
And that's
so I'm a huge fan of Aaron Gordon, Nerlens Noel, for example.
Aaron Gordon.
Yeah, that's a surprising one. That first of all, like some projection models have him rated really, really high in the future, like what they expect of his development. And when you watch him play, he's actually a pretty interesting player in that he makes like these interesting passes that other people don't really see. Most of them end up in turnovers, but I think there's clearly something there about his game. And then hopefully he'll get put at power forward and not small forward anymore. So that will make him a lot better.
Well, I've heard that he wants to play small forward, that he doesn't want to play power forward.
Well, I think most NBA players nowadays probably should be willing to go down a position. And like, it's not just like he can't really shoot, or maybe he can. Who knows from summer league? That doesn't indicate probably anything, or it might. But Aaron Gordon, like, just his mobility, he makes the team faster when he plays power forward, and that's a huge deal. Like for how you play and. And when he rolls to the rim, his passing vision and stuff like that, it's just, and he can guard the position. So I just think it's obvious that he should play power forward, despite what he thinks.
I've got a player for you. You mentioned before we're looking at PER. Is this player had a dip in PER of over 3 this last season? It was his lowest PER in the last 8 seasons. He saw his lowest win shares total since his rookie year, and he saw a drop in his true shooting percentage by 8%. Now,
is this LeBron James?
It's LeBron James. Is he? Yeah. Is last season a sign of regression? Is it a one-off, or can we expect this new LeBron to be? Is this what we're seeing from him? His win shares dropped from 16 down to 10. His PER went from 29 down to 25.9. His true shooting from 65 down to 58. And all these numbers are the numbers he was sort of putting up when he was 22 years old, 2006, 2007 LeBron. These are his worst numbers in a massive stretch of time.
Yeah, yeah. Those metrics typically really value efficiency. So the true shooting is basically the reason why those numbers dipped. I think it probably at this point says more about how LeBron wants to play than his really, really basketball skills deteriorating. So he basically got to choose the offense completely, like a pick and roll offense, nothing like what David Blatt wants to run with, which was like Princeton and cutting and interesting stuff like that from initiating from the high post. And I think it speaks to more of LeBron James going back to like the Magic Johnson mode, than in Miami, where he had his like crazy true shooting years. He got more cuts, more stuff, more in transition, and just getting those baskets would actually push him back up pretty high. So I think it's more a function of how he wants to play more than a function of his actual basketball skills starting to deteriorate.
Right. I had a question. I just thought that was interesting because LeBron's numbers did take a dip. So not necessarily we're looking to downgrade him too much, but if he's going to continue to play that way, then his numbers will stay in a similar mold. So you expect similar numbers, which is not top two fantasy guy, which he was, you know, for so many years. You know, we're talking about a guy who's outside the top five, top six probably, if he keeps those numbers up. Now, a question that's just come in, Mika, you obviously haven't had a chance to see this one, but I'll tell you now. It's from Arnizzle on Twitter, at Der Woodman. Is there a player that is hard to analyze because his playing style changes too often?
That's an interesting one. His playing style changes too often. Do you have anyone in mind?
No,
while I think
I'm trying to think as well. Like, we're talking about guys who sort of reinvent their game. There's not who, look, Kobe has to a degree with his lack of athleticism. He's not dunking over guys necessarily as much. I think Blake Griffin has changed his game quite a bit since when he started. He's not rebounding the ball as much. He's looking to take more long-range shots. He's dribbling the ball more. He's passing the ball more, looking to take set up play more. I think his playing style has changed quite a bit in a short period of time. So he's a name that sort of comes to mind in that sense. No one else is really sort of standing out.
I don't know if it makes it hard to analyze either. I think you can pretty easily analyze Blake Griffin and how he plays and how he's changed and how that impacts the game. I think trying to think of someone who perhaps plays differently every game. I don't know really.
Yeah, I can't think of anyone.
You know, I've never really. Yeah.
I can't think of anyone like that.
I have to say, I've never really liked like gunners. Like Jamal Crawford or players like that much. The game-to-game variance is too big for me to handle. I like players like Kyle Korver who just, like, you do the same thing every single time. You know what he's going to do. You can rely on that. You can build your expectation of how you want to play this game as a coach from that standpoint that you know what's going to happen and how this player will be covered and nothing. Right. I'm a big like system guy, I guess.
I'll give you a name of a player who is probably he's a favorite here on the podcast. He's an anti-system guy. He's an anti-basketball guy, in my opinion. Tony Roten. What's your thoughts on watching him play? How often have you tried to rip your eyeballs out from watching him go around on the court?
Tony Roten is. It's funny because there was this little 2-week period where people. Well, I can't remember what the start of this season, start of the previous season, that people actually thought he might be good.
It was the start of the last season, and people were all over him. And I said, this guy is dreadful. He is horrible. But he put up a lot of numbers.
He really enjoys to have the ball.
That should be his just byline of everything. He just enjoys having the ball. And he doesn't know what to do with it. He just enjoys having it. And he's the butt of a lot of jokes on this show, Mika. I'm not the biggest Tony Roten fan in the world. Now, let's talk about some other things. We've got to finish this off pretty soon, but a couple of things. Let's talk about the Western Conference. Not really fantasy related, but we'll just talk about, you know, how do we think it plays out? How do you think the Western Conference plays out? It's obviously strong. Who's the best?
So I think there's like, people have already elevated the Spurs up to like the team to beat. And I don't think that's true. Golden State was one of the best teams in NBA history last season by all metrics that you can find.
Yep.
And I think they probably won't be as healthy. They got really lucky with that, but they will probably be, again, there's a possibility they're by far the best team still in the West. I do put them on a tier by themselves. And then the second tier, I guess I would put the Spurs and the Spurs if Tim Duncan doesn't decline, which apparently is just never going to happen, so I don't need to be worried about that. And then I think the Clippers have, because they flamed out in the playoffs so fabulously in the past few years, I think it's sort of lost on most people that their like net rating, which is the best indicator of your future performance, past three seasons, they've just like been the second or third best team. And I think they were second last season, if I remember correctly. They should be really, really good. And if they can just get like an 8-man rotation in, that like their top five last season with Matt Barnes and JJ Redick, and like the previous few seasons, for the past like over cumulatively over the past three seasons, that's been the best lineup in the NBA by plus my like on off court numbers. Like that's just. And last year they were eclipsed by the Golden State's best lineup, but that's a monster, monster lineup. And if they can just like get enough rest for those guys, I think that team still is one of the premier contenders.
Last season before the season started, I picked the Clippers to win the title. It looked pretty bad at the start of the season. It started to look really good at the end. And I would not be shocked at all if they won the title again this year. I do agree with you, the Golden State's still probably the best team. But I've got no problem putting the Clippers as number two ahead of the Spurs. The Spurs are great, but I am worried about Tony Parker's decline. He just hasn't been the same guy the last couple of years. Manu Ginobili doesn't play a huge role in this team. Yeah, Kawhi Leonard, I'm a massive Kawhi Leonard fan. LaMarcus Aldridge, I think, is somewhat overrated at times for what he's able to do and contribute to a team. So I'm not quick to put the Spurs at number one. I think I'd be pretty comfortable having the Clippers at number two at this point. The Rockets moves, losing Josh Smith, adding Ty Lawson. What does that make them? They were second in the Western Conference last year. You lost in the conference finals. Do they get better? Do they get worse? What do those moves mean for them?
I have to say, I don't really know where to put the Rockets. It's like, I guess they deserve to be in the category with Spurs and the Clippers, but I don't know how much better Ty Lawson makes them either. I think Beverly's actually, well, he makes it better because he can play some minutes and he's pretty good, but I think Beverly's a pretty nice fit next to Harden. They have one of my favorite players, Demo Motiyunis.
I love that guy. I love him as well.
So it's just he's one of those players who, like every NBA nerd, I think, just thoroughly enjoys, like fantastic passer, moves well, 7 feet tall, like the best post-up player probably in the NBA right now. I don't really know where to put them. I guess you sort of, I wouldn't want to underestimate them. I think even though Kevin McHale doesn't get any credit as a coach, I think they do things, if not creatively, they really play very analytically smart. They really take out like everything that there is to just take out of a series of possessions, and every edge they can get, they really, really just do it in smart ways, I think.
They're a team that frustrating to watch with Howard and Harden's, you know, constant free throws, but you have to respect what they do and the way that they work the system and play smart basketball, because it gets them places. Now, before we go, Miko, I just had another question come through from Wazaman. He has he's given a question to us here. He goes, with Kevin Durant back, does Serge Ibaka revert to his old style, or does he still continue to take threes? What is the correlation between blocks and age as well? So we'll tackle the first bit first. Now, Ibaka played a completely sort of different style at the start of last season. He took a stack of threes when Durant and when Westbrook were out. He was not getting the blocks. He was not getting the rebounds. He was taking a lot of long-range shots. But the second half of the season, he started to revert to that old style that he was doing before. The block numbers went up. The three-point attempts went down. His field goal percentage went up. I think that he goes back to basically doing what he did before. Do you see it a different way, or do you see this as a new Serge Ibaka, a stretch 4-5 Serge Ibaka is going to start taking more of those threes, or is he going to go back to that setup with Durant and Westbrook and him just doing what he needs to do?
Well, I think he's in any case, he's going to be like a stretch big in the sense that his man, it's difficult for his man to rotate, no matter if he shoots from three or from mid-range. So I don't actually mind him taking threes in the right context. I think he'll do really well next season. I'm a big fan of Serge Ibaka.
All right, I think we're pretty much done, Mika, today. Before you go, what sort of stuff are you working on? Have you got anything in the pipeline coming up at Nylon Calculus?
I guess I'm always looking at ideas. I'm sort of really interested right now in things that aren't maybe like the most obvious where analytics has gone, but unlike the thing I mentioned earlier about, so we have shot charts of players from where they shoot, but we don't have missing charts, like understanding like if a player misses a short way too much or left or right. And those things, I think, can be understood. And then you can look back from those and look at film and understand a player's shooting technique and start to adjust for that. So, for example, one nice thing is if you do like Steph Curry versus Klay Thompson and you do you build like a consistency metric of if Klay Thompson misses, how does that impact his probability of making his next shot? And if you do Curry is just like, it's like a coin flip. It doesn't matter. He's not hot or cold. But Klay Thompson actually has like streaks that are a bit, that indicate that he's hot or cold. And when you look at the film, one interesting analysis I saw of his shot was that he doesn't dip the ball every time, but sometimes dips the ball when he goes into his jump shot. So there's a mechanic that isn't consistent, and that may be contributing to, like, overall, he still hits very well, but to his sort of, at least in the mathematical sense, a lack of consistency, I think that exists. So I'm interested in, like, stuff like that, though, where you can tie into, like, coaching decisions or training exercises or stuff like that into analytics. So that's the stuff I'm looking for.
Okay, it'll be interesting to see your stuff come out when you do publish some stuff over on Nylon Calculus. But if you do have any analytics-based questions or any basketball questions, you can hit Mika up on Twitter at mhonkasilo. I will link that in my Twitter account and throughout the website as well, so you can check that out. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and leave me a review. Kick me across a review. You know I always appreciate that, and thanks to all the people who have done that. If you're listening for the first time, maybe on Hardwood Paroxysm Network, thank you for listening, and go ahead and subscribe as well and leave a comment and leave some feedback. It's great to have everyone. It's great to be on board over at Hardwood Paroxysm, and great to have you all listening. A couple of things I need to mention. Don't forget to check out allstar5.com and have a look at that little project that I'm working on with a few other guys, Matt Smith, Seth Klein, Mark Roberts, and Joey Mamoni, working on a little project over there at All Star 5, so check that one out. Mika, thank you very much for coming on. It was good having you here.
It's been great, thank you.
Not a problem. Everybody, follow me on Twitter at redrock_bball, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, subscribe at all those places, like, comment, share, tell your mom, tell everybody. Thank you so much for watching and for listening. See ya.